Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. You can find the club on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and the club's website, commonwealthclub.org. I'm Joe Epstein, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and your chair for tonight's program. This program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is now my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Howard Schultz, former chairman and CEO of Starbucks, and the author of the new book, From the Ground Up, A Journey to Reimagine the Promise of America. From the start of his career, Howard Schultz has always been an unconventional businessman. With health insurance and free college tuition offered to part-time baristas, to initiatives about race and refugees, Mr. Schultz has challenged notions about the traditional role of business in society. Howard Schultz grew up in Brooklyn's public housing and was the first in his family to graduate from college. After founding a small cafe business, he eventually bought Starbucks, which grew from 11 stores to more than 28,000 under his leadership. In the past couple of years, Starbucks has ranked fifth on Fortune's list of the world's most admired companies. He and his wife, Sherry, also co-lead the Schultz Family Foundation. Howard Schultz has been recognized for his passion to strengthen communities and is the recipient of the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Ripple of Hope Award, the Horatio Alger Award, and the Notre Dame University Reverend Theodore Hesburgh Award for Business Ethics. You can learn more about his background and his achievements on his website, howardschultz.com. And as you know, in keeping with his unconventional approach to life, this year Mr. Schultz announced that he is strongly considering a run as an independent candidate for President of the United States in 2020. To ask him about all of this, we are very pleased to have as our moderator Krista Tippett. She's a journalist, she's a former diplomat, and the host of the Peabody Award-winning public radio program and podcast, On Being. She is also the 2019 Mimi and Peter E. Haas Distinguished Visitor at Stanford University Award. Ms. Tippett was awarded the National Humanities Medal by President Obama, and one of her newest endeavors is called the Civil Conversations Project. This is aimed at, and I quote, having the conversations we want to be hearing. Well, that sounds like a very good starting point for tonight's program. So please join me and welcome Howard Schultz and Krista Tippett.
Thank you very much.
Good evening. So lovely to be here. Howard, you grew up in an immigrant family, an immigrant Jewish family, and I've always seen East European, and I wondered which country in Eastern Europe, from which country in Eastern Europe did your family enter the American dream?
So my great-grandfather, Max, came from Belz, Poland, and my great-grandfather, Morris, came from Russia.
Okay.
There you have it.
Yeah. And this mission, the corporate mission statement of Starbucks, to inspire and nurture the human spirit, one person, one cup, and one neighborhood at a time, has that been the mission statement for a long time?
It has been for a long time, and I think it speaks to every company, every enterprise, in my view, needs to have a core purpose and a reason for being. And to provide a sense of core principles and values, and the culture and values of the company followed that mission statement.
So, yeah, I'm really drawn to that language, and I think it's a little bit radical, in fact, for a corporation to talk about inspiring and nurturing the human spirit. And I wonder if I asked you if there was a spiritual background to your life, to your childhood, however you would define that now, yeah, how would you begin to talk about what that was?
In terms of a spiritual background?
Yeah.
I'm getting very personal.
That's what I do.
Well, I think all of us at times find spirituality, especially when you need it the most. Certainly, I've needed it the last 3 weeks.
Yeah.
But I think my faith in God, and growing up Jewish, very culturally in terms of the tradition of being Jewish.
Yeah.
I think there's a spiritual side to the family that we've raised and our kids. And so I think, yes. But in terms of a specific moment, we would need more than 25 minutes.
Yeah, well, you know, when you write in your book, you write a lot about your childhood, and you were just telling me that these are, in fact, stories that you haven't told previously.
Yes.
Even when you write in there was a lot of angst in our seventh-floor apartment. To me, that's also a spiritual background.
Well, I think what you're referring to is in the book, for the first time in my adult life, I reveal stories that, for the most part, only a few people in my life have known, my wife Sherry, my kids, and very close friends. I think I lived with a sense of shame and vulnerability and the scars of growing up as a poor kid in a family that was quite dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. The opening chapter, people read and they go, holy mackerel, what is this book about? My grandmother was a professional gambler. And
your nana.
My nana.
I had one of those too, but she was a really strict preacher, and yours was a poker player.
And so I grew up watching illegal card games basically 3 to 4 nights a week in my house when I was a young boy, being sent to a bedroom and listening to all that during the night. And
not completely feeling safe in your own home, it sounds like.
No, not feeling safe, and then also hiding that from other kids in the neighborhood and other people so that I would appear as if I was living in a normal household. And, you know, in the book, I talk about escaping to a stairwell, which I spent a lot of hours in as a kid. I never knew exactly what was going to happen when I turned the doorknob to my apartment because of the feeling of dysfunction, sometimes rage. And as I write, physical abuse.
Mm-hmm. And then you write a lot about your father.
Yes.
Who had many jobs, and you say somewhere that his main employable skill was driving. When you were 7 years old, he fell on a patch of ice, the kind of thing that can happen to anybody, injured his hip and his ankle, and then really was not able to work again.
Yeah. So that incident of him, he was a blue-collar worker delivering and picking up cloth diapers, fell on a sheet of ice and was fired, no workman's compensation, no health insurance.
No savings.
And I witnessed as a young boy the fracturing of a family as a result of no resources. About once or twice a month, Jewish Family Services would drop off food. And that experience as a young boy began to shape how I would see the world. I never knew that I'd be in a position one day to build a company or to be part of a company, but the fact that health insurance was available 20 years before the Affordable Care Act at Starbucks really was an opportunity for me to try and do something that my father didn't participate in, and that was the dignity of work and a purpose in life. And unfortunately, he felt like he was a victim of the system, when in fact, that is true to a point, but he also did not take personal responsibility.
Hmm. And I mean, you describe growing up really just this image, which really has stayed with me, of seeing your father helpless on the couch.
Yeah.
And that his life was fractured, and also, I think you write somewhere, this was kind of this image for you of a fractured American dream.
Well, I think what I experienced as a kid, many, many other families, especially given today, when you read a statistic in America where it's statistically 40% of American families do not have $400 in the bank for a crisis, that's $400 away from bankruptcy. And so I have a great deal of empathy and compassion for what's going on in the country, having lived through something like that. But money and the pressure of bill collectors and never having enough resources was a constant feeling within my young childhood, and also shaped a sense of insecurity, fear of failure, and also mm-hmm. trying to figure out how I was going to get out of Brooklyn. The flip side of the story is my mother, who had this deep belief in the country and had a special, one-of-a-kind relationship with President Kennedy. She never met him, but there's a story in the book where, if you don't mind, can I tell it?
Sure.
So every Wednesday afternoon where I grew up, there was no public library, and so we had a bookmobile. And the bookmobile, every Wednesday afternoon, my mother would pick me up from school, we'd walk by the hand, she'd take me, I'd get a book, we'd read it and return back. And then one afternoon, I thought we're going to the bookmobile, she takes me and we're on a bus. I was never on a bus with my mother my entire life. I didn't know where she was taking me. And we get off the bus and we walk what it seemed like a couple of miles, and there's a huge crowd gathered, and I'm holding my mother's hand. I can't see over the crowd, but she's holding me tight, and my mother's face is glowing because we're witnessing a campaign stop of a young senator campaigning for president, and that was John F. Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And she took me to hear him. I was only 7 or 8 at the time. And again, she had this very unique relationship as if he was speaking to her that your station in life did not define who you could be. And she drilled in me as a kid, you were going to college one way or another. And it's because of her mm-hmm. That I did.
And you were the first person in your family to go to college. Is that right?
Yes.
And
yes.
I did. You write that your parents were not able to attend your graduation.
No,
that is really sad.
Yeah. The issue of shame and vulnerability. Also, sometimes you're trying to cover up truth. And so I graduated from college, and my parents could not afford to come to Michigan where I was going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to kind of invent a story. Why they weren't there. And of course, I was deeply embarrassed and hurt by it. But I'm sure there's other people in this audience that have had experiences like that. And you just learn how to kind of navigate through life. And it was very lonely
mm-hmm.
not to be able to celebrate that with my parents. And unfortunately, you can't replace that.
Yeah, right. So I did not actually understand until I was reading your book that Starbucks was actually a coffee company that was one of your customers.
Yes.
A little company. You were a door-to-door office equipment salesman, but it wasn't... They sold coffee, right?
Yes.
There was no seating. It wasn't
a
coffee
house. They sold coffee beans, no beverages,
mm-hmm.
yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then something happened.
And then something happened. But were you enchanted with, even though that wasn't a coffee house, it sounds like you were enchanted somehow with Starbucks.
I was. I walked into the original store in the Pike Place Market, the public market in Seattle, and just felt like I had an epiphany that this is a place that I want to learn more about. I was very curious about, and basically talked myself into a job in 1982.
In marketing.
Yeah, in marketing. And then a year later, I was sent by the founders of Starbucks to Italy my first time, and once again had another epiphany. I've had a number of those.
All right. What did you write? You wrote, Italians understand the emotional relationship people have with coffee.
Yes. So I ran into these coffee bars, these espresso bars in Milan, and the sense of community, which I kind of interpreted as this third place between home and work, and the expression, the romance, and the theater of espresso.
Right,
so
the choreographed performance of the barista.
Yeah, the whole deal. I had it in my mind. I rushed mm-hmm. back to Seattle, and I my excitement is just beaming, and I share it with the primary owner of Starbucks, and he basically didn't like the idea.
Right.
And I was saying, what are you talking about? This is brilliant. And one thing led to another, and I decided to leave Starbucks and form my own company. I didn't have any money, and my wife, who's here tonight, was pregnant with our first child, and we raised enough money to open up 3 stores. And then Starbucks and Pete's Coffee Company, based in San Francisco, were once one company.
Oh.
And many people don't know that, and Starbucks got into financial trouble. So the owner said, I'm going to move to San Francisco and stay with Pete's, and I'd like to sell Starbucks to you. That was great news, but I had no money. And so in 1987, I was given the exclusive opportunity to buy Starbucks for $3.8 million, six stores, and I was given a 60-day exclusive to buy the company. So 30 days in, he came to me and said, how are you doing raising the money? And I said, well, I've got half of it raised, and I'm sure I'm going to find the rest. I didn't know where, but I was sure. And he said to me, he laid a bomb, and he said, we got a problem. One of your investors has come to me with an all-cash offer for $4 million, no due diligence, and wants to close in a week. And I said, that's impossible. You gave me an exclusive, and who's the guy? And it turned out to be like the titan of Seattle who went around me and was going to steal the company. And I was crushed beyond belief. And within 24 hours, I found myself being introduced by a good friend of mine to the senior partner of the law firm in Seattle, who was the lawyer in town. And his name was Bill Gates. But not the Bill Gates. His father. So did you all get that? It's a little confusing. I never heard of Bill Gates, either one at the time.
Bill Gates Sr.
Yeah, this is Bill Gates Sr. And so I go see Bill Gates Sr., and I'm so nervous. My heart's palpitating. I'm a kid. I got no idea what's going to happen here. And I tell him the whole story, and he says, I'm going to ask you two questions. Did everything you tell me true? I said, yes. And did you leave anything out? I said, no, I've left nothing out, Mr. Gates. And he says, basically, come back in 2 hours. I said, okay. So I leave, and I figure this is the way things get done. You leave in 2 hours, you come back, and they solve the problem. So I come back in 2 hours, and he says, we're going for a walk. And I said, where are we going? And he said, we're going to see the man, like the Titan. And I'm just freaking out. I have no idea what's going to happen. We go into his office. I don't know if he called ahead or not. And he stands over the guy. And Bill Gates Sr. is 6'7". He's just a mountain of a man. And he says, you should be ashamed of yourself. You were not going to steal this kid's dream. So here's what's going to happen. You're going to stand down.
Oh, he's talking to the Titan.
Yeah, he's talking to the
yes,
Titan.
Yes.
I'm just watching all this, saying, you know, holy.
You're David in the room.
Basically, we walk out, and I say to Mr. Gates, what just happened? And he said, you're going to buy the company, and my son and I are going to help you. Now, there's a punchline here, and the punchline is 30 years later, Bill Gates Sr. never told a soul that he helped me. The man had such humility. Mm-hmm. And it was an incredible, he was an angel for me, never sent me a bill, invested in the company, and helped me raise the money, and the Titan, I never heard from him again, and never told anyone publicly who it was.
Amazing.
Years later, I told Bill Gates who it was, and he said, holy shit.
And he didn't know either.
No. Here's the thing. Bill Gates, the Bill Gates. And he said, no, it gets confusing. Bill Gates Sr. never told his son what he had done. And a year and a half ago at the Microsoft CEO Summit, I'm speaking, and someone says, you got to tell the Bill Gates story. And Bill and Melinda are in the front row. I get off the stage, and Bill said, I did not know the story. I never heard that. My father never told me anything.
Well,
all Bill wanted to know was, who was it?
So I was thinking as I was preparing to be with you tonight, that how aware I am of what coffee culture and coffee house culture in the United States, how much it really owes to you and to Starbucks. And what's kind of interesting at this juncture is that you succeeded so wildly that I think new generations take it for granted, right? Mm-hmm. They don't remember when that didn't exist. I mean, I was in Europe, and living in Europe in the years that you were creating Starbucks, and kind of came home to something that was completely new here.
Well, I think we had so much trouble raising money to grow the company because at the time, there wasn't good coffee in America. And no one could believe that we were going to sell coffee for $2 to $3 a cup with Italian
names. Yeah, it was
names.
Folgers and Maxwell House.
Yeah, that Italian names no one could pronounce. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that it worked. But the other thing was that no one wanted us to be able to build a company in which people came first. And I think the whole idea of health insurance, equity in the form of stock options, free college tuition, all of that was met with tremendous resistance by shareholders and venture capitalists at the time who didn't understand that what we're really trying to do is build a different kind of company that would balance profit and humanity. And the success of the company is really based on culture and a set of values.
Yes, and so a couple of weeks ago, actually before I knew I would be doing this, I was sitting with some friends, and you had just, I think on 60 Minutes, not announced that you were running for president, but announced that you were considering running for president. And this 16-year-old daughter said, and it wasn't, it wasn't hostile the way she said
Don't
this.
Don't worry
okay?
about it.
She said
she wouldn't be the
she
first.
Said something like, "How does being able to make a latte qualify you to run for president?" I actually don't know how good you are at I'm pretty sure you're not as good at making really beautiful creamy flowers on top of lattes as
we
my daughter.
We should go to a store tomorrow
barista.
And I should make you coffee.
Can you do that? Okay. But what I do recall, which I think is lost a bit to memory, is precisely this, that Starbucks was such a different kind of company.
Yeah.
The matter of employees as shareholders. Right. Do you call partners?
Yeah.
Yeah, just that language. The health insurance, which was really extraordinary at that point and actually still extraordinary. Yeah. And then more recently, the tuition-free college education.
Yes.
And, you know, we are in a moment right now where precisely this conversation is rising up about workplaces and companies and what is valued, and not just livable wage, but I'm really curious about how, and I'm spending these 10 weeks out here in Silicon Valley, and a lot of the conversation turns to how, if companies are going to enact different values and reward different things, which would entail a shift in the profit structure.
Yes.
Some kind of shift.
Yes.
That, in fact, it's not just corporate leaders who have to change, it's board expectations and shareholder expectations. So how did you navigate that at Starbucks?
Well, first thing I'd say is I think you're alluding to something that's pretty important, and as we were living at a very fragile time where there has been a lack of trust in public institutions, a lack of trust in government, and a lack of dignity in terms of the level of civility in our daily discourse. A few years back, I stood up in front of a few thousand people at a Starbucks annual meeting, and I posed a question. And the question was, what is the role and responsibility of a for-profit company at a time like this? And this was 2014.
Yeah.
And what I was suggesting at the time was that we have a responsibility that the rules of engagement for a public company today are much different. We have to do more for our people and more for the communities we serve. Now, I don't think we have a crisis of capitalism, but I think we have a crisis of fairness. And the level of inequality in the country is at a level right now where I think we all should be concerned, because the greatness of the country and the promise of the country cannot be fulfilled if millions of people are both left behind and feel as if the promise of the country and the American dream is not accessible to them. So your question about Starbucks, if I can just try and answer that, because a lot of it is linked, like all of us, to my childhood experience. Our childhood experience imprints who we are and shapes how we would see things. So for the last 36 years, every Monday morning we have a leadership meeting at Starbucks, and every quarter we have a board meeting. And for 36-plus years, I've had two chairs in that room that were empty. And everyone understood what it is I was thinking about, metaphorically. and that was that those chairs represented a Starbucks customer and a Starbucks employee, Starbucks mm-hmm. partner.
Mm-hmm.
And all I wanted was for everyone in the room to understand that every decision we're going to make is going to have a significant level of impact on those two people, customers and partners. So let's make decisions that are going to make them proud.
But I can imagine, now tell when you, remind me how that was structured. When you gave health insurance.
Yes.
Even to, I think, part-time employees,
yes.
right?
Yeah.
I am sure that your board didn't jump up and down and say what a great idea that is.
No, I mean.
So how did you, so how did you, what was the argument you
made?
The
argument was this. The argument was that Starbucks Coffee Company then and today has not one single patent, no technology whatsoever. Anyone can open up a coffee store, and many people have, obviously. So what is our competitive advantage? Our competitive advantage is the experience in our stores, which is brought to life by people. And people and the humanity of the company is what the business is that we are in. And if we are going to be successful, we have to exceed the expectations of our people first so they can exceed the expectations of the customer. And the argument was that we would have a lower level of attrition and a higher level of performance if we provide benefits that are unique to the retail industry. And we took it a step further because when the Affordable Care Act came out, which was a very good idea at the time and still a good idea but needs to be fixed, is that the Affordable Care Act was 30 hours, qualifications mm-hmm. were 30 hours. Mm-hmm. Well, we were at 20.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave health care to everyone in the company, part-time or full-time, worked 20 hours a week. And the pressure from the shareholders was the Affordable Care Act is at 30, so you can go to 30 and reduce your level right. of expense by tens of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And we said, no, we can't do that. We're not basing our values on the government. It's based on who we are as people.
And did that prove to be true, that your attrition rate was lower?
Yeah, our attrition rate was lower. I think the lowest in the entire retail industry over the last 20 years. And Starbucks, to its credit, not mine, I think for the eighth consecutive year, was just voted one of the top companies, Fortune's number five company, most admired in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because the biggest lesson we've learned over these years is that not every business decision should be an economic one.
Right.
Now, you have to make money, and you've got to be profitable.
Yeah, I think that's the question also. If it hadn't worked out in business terms, it's clear to me that you still think it is the right thing. And I think that's the kind of this juncture we're at in this country of saying, can we reimagine what we expect?
We have to reimagine it. Mm-hmm. And I think, we are all living at a time right now. If you don't mind, I'm going to ask a question to the audience. Is that okay? No? Okay, I won't do it.
No, go ahead.
I won't do it. I've been asking this question of other audiences. The question I've asked is, does anyone in the audience feel as if the government is doing well for you and your family at this time in America? And I think most people feel as if the government's letting us down. And I think we have to reimagine an opportunity sitting here today that we all recognize there's something not quite right, and we can do better, we can fix these problems, but we have to come together. And the only way we can come together is having a common purpose to reimagine the fact that the greatness of America is in front of us, not behind us.
Mm. I want to ask you for a few more minutes, and then we're going to open it up to the room, about some influences you write about on your thinking and your values. And one of them would be the notion of servant leadership, which Robert Greenleaf kind of coined in the 1970s. And there are many traditions of servant leadership. But is that the tradition that you were drawing on? How did you come across that? And what has that meant in terms of your leadership?
Well, I think every organization has a memory. And every organization is imprinted with behaviors, just like a young child. And you start out with an organization, and you establish a level of leadership. Servant leadership is about being truthful, being transparent, being vulnerable, and creating an environment where people literally feel they're part of something larger than themselves, and there's a set of guiding principles that is going to be the lens in which you're going to make decisions. And everything we've tried to do as a company, and we're not perfect and we make mistakes, but the leaders of the company are threaded together not by being the same kind of people, but having the same kind of values. Mm-hmm. And I think servant leadership at Starbucks has meant that we have linked shareholder value with value for our people and tried every step of the way to recognize that you can't create value externally unless you are leading in a way that you're creating value internally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think servant leadership
that
also...
That authenticity of being... internally what you are externally.
Yeah, and I think people are longing for authenticity.
Mm-hmm. What, there's some phrase, that servant leadership, service is a natural desire, but a conscious choice.
It's interesting because I was talking to a friend of mine who's in the audience today, and I was asking him his thoughts about national service. When you are doing something, and this is such an old adage, it seems so trite, but you get so much more back when you are giving something to someone else. And, you know, right now, we're living at a time where there's so many people who are literally not part of the mainstream success of the country. And the level of concern and, unfortunately, hate and fear that is emerging is because of the level of inequality, but also people feel as if they have lost a voice.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a large...
And so they have to yell.
They have to yell. They feel as if they're not being valued, not being respected. And I think we have an obligation as a country and as leaders, as servant leaders, to do all that we can to create the opportunity and the empowerment for other people to come up. And if we don't recognize where we are right now and do something about that, we're going to end up with a different kind of country. Mm. And I think we've worked too hard, but I'm going to say something that might sound controversial. The gift of America, and I say this as someone who loves the country, but the gift of America is not an entitlement, and we have to earn it. And we have been given this extraordinary privilege to live in a country where your station in life, the color of your skin, your sexual orientation does not define the opportunity you have. But we are so divided right now that we're taking all this for granted and we're losing the opportunity that I think is in front of us. And the question is, how do we come together? What's the unifying message? What's the aspirational goal? But we will be much stronger as a country if we can recognize that we are stronger when we are in it together. And in it together means everyone must have an opportunity.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 500 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. Now, back to our program.
So you write in the book about this, you say, the odd phenomenon of acquiring a lot of money quickly.
Uh-huh.
And because you've been on both ends of this American spectrum of their relationship to money. You've had none, and you've had a lot. You said that not having money is a body blow to body and soul. I want to open this up to the room, but I want to name the fact that we're in this moment in which there is this kind of new conversation and reckoning and a new kind of anger coming up. And I think Americans are very, of two minds. We in this country honor the earning of money. And I think more than Europeans, mm-hmm. there's an assumption that if you've made money, you've done good. You deserve it. But right now there's a new anger. And just, you know, suddenly there's an argument with capitalism, which is really interesting because we haven't had that argument in this country. And I think the word billionaire is very suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just really curious about because you are a billionaire. I'm really curious about how you're listening to this, what you're learning from it, kind of how it's taking your thinking and shaping your presence as you step into this moment.
Well, I think with great success and or wealth comes great responsibility. And I recognize that more than ever, given the conversation we've had and what we've been talking about. But if I think about the aspiration of the country, especially someone who is self-made, and there's so many other people like that in America, I think it's critically important that we don't vilify success, but with success comes responsibility. And responsibility means that you've got to pay it forward. But I think we are also shifting from one extreme to the other in the country right now. And I think there should be a more sensible approach to try and solve these kind of problems. So if you don't mind, I'm going to speak to that.
Yeah.
The reason I said what I said on 60 Minutes about considering running for president as a centrist independent outside of the two-party system is because the extremes on both sides, the far right and the far left, I think are offering solutions that I think are not sensible, not achievable, and don't represent the majority of how American people are thinking about things.
So let me just insert this question, which speaks to what you're saying from the audience. Given the realities of our two-party system, do you think running for president as an independent is the best use of your talents and resources if the goal is to address the current crisis in D.C.?
Yeah. How many people are familiar with the Green New Deal? I think the people who wrote that proposal are well-intentioned and care deeply about the country. But I also believe that when you have a responsibility, if you're going to offer something up, it has to be reasonable and it has to be achievable. On the other side, that's the Democratic, far-left Democratic side, the far-right on the Republican side doesn't seem to want to do much in terms of helping those people who are being left behind. They don't want to see the issue of science be respected in terms of climate change, and also don't want to see much being changed to the healthcare crisis we have, other than Republicans saying they want to eradicate the Affordable Care Act without offering any solution. But the other side, the Democrats, are saying basically Medicare for all. In the state of California, where we are tonight, you know, the annual budget for the state of California is approximately $175 billion. Medicare for all in the state of California is about $400 billion. And so I just ask, how are you going to pay for that? And in the Green New Deal, there's a proposal that says every building in the United States by 2030 is going to have clean energy. And so I read that, and I said, well, first off, the government doesn't own those buildings. Those buildings are owned by private people. And then I did the math, and it suggests that basically we'd have to convert 2,700 buildings a day to clean energy. And who's going to pay for all this? And the other issue is, you know, as we sit here as Americans today, we have $22 trillion of national debt and about $450 billion of interest every year. And that is a reckless example in which both parties have been complicit. Both parties, 8 years while President Obama was president, the Republicans banged on him every single day to reduce the debt and the deficit. Trump comes in office, two years have gone by. I haven't heard one Republican with one voice in either chamber say anything about the national debt other than the fact that Trump is adding $1 trillion a year. And that money is going to be on the backs of our kids and our grandkids, and the country's not going to be able to invest in our future. And so what I'm saying is I'm looking at the landscape of the lack of leadership, the extremes on both sides, not being able to give us an immigration bill when 79% of the American people want a sensible immigration bill. It seems to be it's a sensible thing to do. Absolutely do everything possible to restrict the right kind of situation at the border. We don't need a wall. We have the best technologies in the country here in California. I'm sure they can solve the problem. And I think the Dreamers, the humanity of the country, the Dreamers should have access to citizenship, and the 11 million people who are here unauthorized should get in line, pay taxes, and we should vet them and we should go forward. But also we should recognize that the foundation of the country is based on immigration, that the majority of people here, right in this room, are here because of immigration.
Including you.
Yeah. And we seem to be rejecting all of this and accepting it. And I just want to raise my hand and say, listen, I don't think this is normal, the lack of leadership, the lack of truth, the extremes on both sides, and that the system is not working for the American people. And someone should stand up and say, I think there's a better way. And the other thing I'd say is that 42% of the American people, 30% are registered independents, and 12% say, I would be affiliated with an independent if I had a choice. That's more than either party. And so before we rush to judgment about what it is I'm considering doing it because I think we are at a moment in time where we must recognize that the system is not working for us as Americans, and I believe we can do better, and I believe we can fix it, because there's a lack of truth and a lack of leadership.
So here's a question. How do you think businesses can help raise the minimum wage in the U.S.? Do you think businesses should raise the minimum wage in the U.S.?
So there's been a great debate, you know, whether or not $15 an hour should be a federal mandate or that should be the role and responsibility of the states, each state. In the state of Washington, we were one of the first states to go to $15 an hour. What we're witnessing in Washington is that there is a great deal of concern about a lack of job creation as a result of $15 an hour and pressure on small businesses. So what I would say is that I think it's too early to rush to judgment that it should be a national mandate. Perhaps it should, but it's too early. And at this time, I think it should be up to the state to decide what the minimum wage should be in each state of the country.
Mm-hmm. Question about what has been? I think I want to add to this question. What has been your proudest moment leading Starbucks, and also what would you think of as your hardest moment?
I think the proudest moment was when we gave equity in the form of stock options to everyone at Starbucks, and we created system-wide ownership. So Starbucks went public in 1992. In 1991. 14% of everyone's base pay was given to them every single year in the form of stock options, so everyone was an owner. And that changed the culture and value of the company and performance. Now, going back to your earlier question, there was tremendous pressure not to do this because everyone thought it would be dilutive. And I'm proud to say that Starbucks stock, since we went public, is up about 24,000%, so it worked. And everyone at Starbucks participated in that. Perhaps the roughest moment was in 2008. Starbucks was almost insolvent as a result of the cataclysmic financial crisis and self-induced mistakes. And Starbucks at the time had a disease in the company, which was hubris. Now, I had left and wasn't the CEO, but I was still culpable because I was the chairman. And that was a very, very tough time in trying to transform and bring the company back. And, of course, we had a very difficult time in Philadelphia this past year as well.
Right. What did you learn from that? What did you take out of that?
How in
did
Philadelphia?
That change you? Yeah, that experience of the two men who employees Starbucks called the police. They were African-American.
Yes. You know, that was one of the toughest moments for all of us at Starbucks, to think that could happen in our company, but it did. And the truth is it could happen anywhere.
Because it happens all the time.
So two African-American gentlemen came in. They wanted to use the bathroom, and the manager, who was white, said, you have to buy something. And one thing led to another, and there was a couple of issues that happened, and quickly she called 911. Police came and literally arrested and handcuffed the two African-American men for no reason. Now, there was a rush to judgment in the company that it was the manager's fault. And the truth is, it wasn't. It was the company's fault because we had a policy that was very loose and it was not well-defined. And what I learned about that is a number of things. One, and I hope this isn't controversial, but I learned that every one of us, at least in my own view, has some level of unconscious bias. And based on our own history, life experience, and how difficult it is to talk about race. It's uncomfortable, but it's necessary. And so we developed a curriculum with the help of African-American thought leaders who could help us understand how to talk about this, how to train our people. We closed our stores for a full day, and we've kept the curriculum going. And I think we also did something inside the company a year before that, which was something called Race Together, where I had the brilliant idea of trying to raise the national conversation about race and thought maybe a good idea was to put the two words on a cup, and that failed miserably.
Okay.
And that was my idea.
Right.
And it was celebrated in the company that was my idea. I'm saying that kiddingly. But the point is, we started having town hall meetings around the country with our employees at Starbucks about racial injustice and race. And, you know, I think the big learning is the country has a long way to go, but we have to have the courage to have these conversations. And as Melody Hobson, who sits on the Starbucks board, has kind of taught all of us, we have to be brave about it. And I think there certainly is a lot of lessons learned. Nobody wants to go through that situation that we went through. And it was a very tough emotional period for the company, but also we've tried to learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Would you support universal basic income as an alternative to Green New Deal? I mean, I think you may have touched on this a little bit, but
yeah,
this is another nuance of that.
So what I think is needed is right now we're in the middle of what appears to be a campaign season for the Democrats. And it seems like every day there's a press release or an announcement of a new initiative. And most of these initiatives are not going to pass Congress. Most of these initiatives are about a press release or trying to score some political points. And so what I think is necessary is for us to take a big step back and diagnose what the real problems are and then try and solve the problem in a comprehensive way as opposed to trying to just issue a press release about some kind of wealth tax or 70% income tax. What we need in America is compassion and empathy for the millions of people who are being left behind and a comprehensive level of tax reform. I thought President Trump's idea, which was passed through Congress, of reducing the corporate tax rate from 35 to 21%, even though our company was going to benefit from it, was a terrible mistake. And it was a mistake because he missed a giant opportunity for comprehensive tax reform. I've said publicly that people of who are earning millions of dollars should be paying more in taxes. People in the middle class and lower should be paying less, and the corporate tax rate should go up. And there should be incentives built into the corporation for training and doing everything you can for the communities you serve. But to give a flat reduction from 35 to 21% to reward shareholders and the people on the inside with a mistake. And we ended up giving 60% of that back to our employees because we just felt it was the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm. What are the main core values that have helped keep you grounded and centered through times of struggle?
My wife, Sherry's here tonight. Where is she? Somewhere. Sherry, raise your hand. Oh, okay. So marrying a young lady from the Midwest, from Lima, Ohio, with strong Midwestern values, who can tell you to take the garbage out, and someone who has compassion and empathy and really can help you during times of real personal trial has been the guiding strength, no doubt about that. And I think everything I've done in life is skewed towards the vulnerability of my childhood and trying to overcome the feeling of trying to make my parents proud. I know it sounds strange. My parents did not really get to see my success, and I think I've tried over the years to do things that unfortunately they did not get to see. I also have a deep sense of sensibility because of how I grew up. I that has not left me. Mm-hmm. And I have the scars they don't get removed. And so everything I've tried to do with
this is the human condition you're describing. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. You in the book you write about use the language a lot of vulnerability and humility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that those are values for you. And it's interesting because you've stepped out into the public sphere in a new way. We do not reward vulnerability. I mean, in life, we all know in life that vulnerability and humility, when we experience those things, when we grow more deeply into them, those are the only times that we have a chance to learn and grow. But publicly, we don't reward expressions of the embodiment of vulnerability and humility in public figures.
But if you think about our own personal life, you are most often drawn to somebody when they are vulnerable with you.
Right.
And you are drawn to people who demonstrate a level of humbleness because it's qualities and virtues that you admire in others. Unfortunately, the way life works now, if you do anything like that publicly, you're vilified for being weak. And I don't see it as a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've cried in front of Starbucks people when I've apologized for something that we've not done well, and I felt like we've let them down. And I don't think it's a sign of weakness. And I think I've learned over the years that it can be a sign of strength. And I think as men, we're taught not to demonstrate those feelings, but it's a sign of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it takes courage sometimes to demonstrate that level of openness. And that's why I've tried to do that in the book, because it took me 65 years to basically share those stories that I've been hiding.
Hmm. Here's a question. Some, especially in the working class, believe that globalization and free trade have destroyed jobs in America, and with jobs, dignity and community. Do you agree? And is there anything you would change in our current trade relations to improve American communities?
Yeah. How many people read the book Janesville? Anyone? So in reading the book about Janesville, it's basically about an auto plant that's closing. And then we saw that in the last few months in Youngstown, Ohio. The issue of globalization has played a significant role in the reduction of manufacturing jobs in America. I think after World War II, there were more than 50 million manufacturing jobs in America, and I think today there's less than 10 million. I don't think you can put that all on the burden of globalization. I think there's lots of reasons for that. I think the bigger question today is with the rise of AI and robotics and a new level of technology that's going to be a tidal wave of change with regard to the job skills necessary for the future, what is America going to do to try and narrow the job skill gap that is already pretty wide in order to catch the wave of the jobs necessary for the future? And I think that speaks, in my mind, to a different level of education. And so on one hand, we've got a serious issue with K through 12 in America, in which we are now the 24th or 25th nation. We used to be number one or number two. And we have 60 to 70% of people going to college who are not finishing. And so we have to reimagine the education system in America in order to provide the level of skills and training. I don't think the burden of that is on totally on globalization or trade. I think we have fallen behind as a country in terms of the of education, of standards, of accountability. I also believe that universities that are not held accountable for graduation rates should not be allowed to accept federal aid. I think that's a mistake. I also and now I'm getting into one other subject, which is, you know, we have an indebtedness of over $1 trillion of student loans in America. But how many people in the audience realize that the United States government is charging 6 to 8% interest on those loans, and the loan, the interest rate should be about 2%. So the United States government is making money on the interest of student loans today, which I think is just tragic. And again, another example of the complicitness of both parties and the lack of empathy and compassion for those students who cannot afford to stay in school because of the of level of debt. So we've got an education crisis that needs to be reimagined. It's easy to point to globalization, but a lot of it is in our own doing.
Right. I think this question gets back to the idea of potentially running as an independent.
Yeah.
How can centrism be revived in America? Do people still really want centrism? And I think also, you know, implied in that is, I mean, how do you think, what is the center?
Yeah, what is,
does the
what
center
does
exist?
I'm thinking about the word centrism or centrist. Let's take that out of the, and just talk about just basic level of fairness, of compromise, of collaboration. We have a United States government today that, for whatever reason, is unwilling to collaborate, unwilling to compromise, and unwilling to see that the majority of Americans want to see solutions to these problems. And all I'm suggesting is that there is a middle ground, that if you could put people in the room who are not coming into the room with a level of ideology and self-interest and self-preservation. And remember those two chairs in the Starbucks boardroom and the two chairs that I talked about? What if there was just one chair in every room in the halls of Washington, and that one chair was the American people? And you couldn't leave the room until you represented and solved their problem. That is what I mean about being a centrist. And I think we've gotten to the point where the extremes on both sides, the leadership on both sides, have lost an understanding of what they were elected to do. They were not elected to represent the ideology in the extreme. They were represented, they were there and elected and to represent the American people. And the American people, I think, have an expectation that's not being met. And how long can we go like this before we kind of hit a collision course with time? And I don't want to see Donald Trump reelected, but I also believe, and this might sound controversial, that if Donald Trump runs against a far left-leaning Democrat, the chances of him getting reelected, in my view, are pretty high. And I don't want to see that happen, and I want to see Donald Trump fired.
So I think this is going to be our last question. How will you continue to support, and this question comes from a dreamer
okay.
in the audience. How will you continue to support the immigrant dreamers as former CEO and potential presidential nominee?
Okay. I don't know where you are in the audience, but I want to speak directly to you. And I've gone down to the southern border. And I spent time in McAllen, Texas, and I spent time with people who told me a couple of stories that I want to share with this audience. One is that a husband and wife no longer can go to church together or no longer can go to a supermarket together for fear of them together being picked up and their kids who were born here and our American citizens will not have parents. And when you sit down and you hear that, and a mother starts crying, you ask yourself about the humanity of the country. And I think it is the humanity of the country that I think needs to be preserved and once again enhanced. What is the humanity of the country? It is kindness, it's goodness, and it's recognizing that we are a country that has constantly been facing challenges, but has always found a way to embrace the promise of America. And to the young person who asked that question, when President Trump came out with his ban against Muslims, Starbucks within 24 hours decided that we were going to release a press release that said, we're going to immediately hire 10,000 refugees. Now, we didn't do that for marketing. We didn't do that for any other reason than to demonstrate to our own people, 350,000 people who work for our company, the values of our company, that the values of Starbucks are based on a diverse workforce, and the diversity of the company is based on a collective set of values and guiding principles. And we should not be a company that excludes people. We should be a company that has a level of openness. And with regard to the country, there are certainly bad people who want to come in. Those people should not be allowed to come in. But the issue of building a wall is not just a physical wall. It is a sign. It's a sign to the rest of the world that we're closing ourselves in. The world needs American leadership. The world needs American values. America should not be building walls. We should be building bridges to allow people in and to extend ourselves to the rest of the world. And this is a time, a real important time, with whether you are Republican or Democrat or view my interest in being an independent, however you view it. When we leave here tonight, we are all Americans. And I want to go back to what I said earlier. We're not entitled to the gifts of the country. We have to earn it. And one of the ways I think we earn it is to constantly demonstrate the idealism of what America has stood for and the sacrifice that so many people have had who have come before us, who have given us this gift. So when it comes to Dreamers and the initial question, we all have to do everything we can to maintain and enhance the values of the country. And it is beyond me, my understanding, why the Dreamers have not been given status and given a pathway to citizenship, because they deserve it, and they deserve it today.
So I think one of the knots we've tied ourselves in this country, on every side of every spectrum, is that we are much more sophisticated and practiced at describing what we're fighting against, mm-hmm. what we're criticizing, what we need to, you know, tear down, disrupt. And I think you are already speaking to the final question I wanted to ask you, which is, would you just say a few more words, because you have been speaking to this, about the America, the future that you want us to be walking towards, the mm-hmm. you know, and the America that you want your young grandchildren
yes.
to grow up in. Mm-hmm. What are the qualities of that America? What are its capacities, and what questions is it asking?
Mm-hmm. You know the feeling that we all get when we watch the Olympics, and the pride that we feel when we see the American flag hoisted up and the national anthem played at the Olympics, when some extraordinary young athlete wins a gold medal. Somehow, regardless of your day and your feeling, something happens. You get goosebumps, you get pride, you feel the aspiration, and you're looking at something that you don't know the person, you don't know the situation, but we're all glued to the fact that America has won. And you're glued to the fact that there's a level of personal pride that we all get in seeing the American flag go up and the national anthem be played. And somehow there is a thread to all of us about that feeling. And right now, we're living at a time when, for whatever reason, we're not as proud of the country as we perhaps have been at other times in our life. And I think we're not as proud of it because people have led us to believe that we are divided, that there's hate, that there's fear. I don't believe we are as divided. I don't believe there is as much hate as there is on cable news. And as I have traveled to other parts of the country and gone into small communities, and I see extraordinary, heroic people doing things because of the kindness of loving thy neighbor, and it's a quality that you can't teach, but you see it, is I want us all to be proud of the country again. I want us all to look at each other not as people who are different than us because of the color of our skin, the sexual orientation, the gender, whatever the issue. I want us to once again be proud of the country because we stand for things that are right and just. I don't want us to be desensitized from this time because it's not normal. It's not normal to have someone in the White House who is undignified. It's not normal to see a level of civility and disrespect that this man constantly preaches as a result of his own level of hatred and conceit and narcissism. And he is the person who is demonstrating the character of the nation to every American citizen and to the world. And the world is longing for American leadership. The world is longing for American values. And all I can say is I'm here today because I want to do everything I can to elevate those values in any way that I can. And over the next few months, I'm going to try and answer my own question with my wife and our family as to whether or not I have a role to play in trying to make that happen. But we all have been, at one time or another, extremely, extraordinarily proud of the country. And I think we have work to do to elevate that pride again and answer the question, is this the kind of country we want for our children and our grandchildren? And right now, I think there's work to do. And I know we can fix these problems. I know we can get past this moment in time. But we have to do it together.
The Commonwealth Club thanks Howard Schultz, former chairman and CEO of Starbucks and author of the new book, From the Ground Up, A Journey to Reimagine the Promise of America. We also thank everyone here as well as our audience on radio, television, and the internet. This program has been part of the Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Mr. Schultz's book are available in the lobby. I'm Krista Tippett, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you. Great. Made it easy.